content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the August 12th, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows a roller coaster. It's up high, it's in the clouds, very steep and twisty. The one cart on the roller coaster is red. It has the presidential seal on the front of it. In the front seat is a smiling Joe Biden holding on to the rail. In the back seat are Jerome Powell and Janet Yellen with a concerned looks on their face, and the cart's just starting to go down a really steep drop. The headline is, "The Ride Gets Rougher. As spending and demand subside, is the U.S. heading into a recession?" And I believe that may be a business article, but we will start, as usual, with the main stories and how they were covered. Manchin's reversal opens door for climate tax bill. What happened? Democrats pushed to bring their $433 billion climate taxation and health care bill to the Senate floor this week after a stunning turnaround by centrist Senator Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, brought the seemingly dead package back to life. The bill, a key piece of President Biden's domestic agenda and the most ambitious federal climate legislation ever, appeared to hit a dead end just 2 weeks ago after Manchin, a crucial vote in the evenly divided Senate, said he wouldn't support it for fear it would worsen inflation. But he and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer quietly resumed talks, and after inflation hawk economist Larry Summers and corporate leaders told Manchin they supported a revised bill, Democrats announced agreement on a package, now dubbed the Inflation Reduction Act. The bill contains $369 billion in climate spending, including tax credits for building solar and wind power and buying electric vehicles. It would extend subsidies for millions of Obamacare users and lower prescription drug costs by allowing Medicare to negotiate some prices. It would also raise an estimated $739 billion in new revenue, enough to offset the bill's cost and pay $300 billion toward deficit reduction, in part by imposing a 15% minimum tax on large corporations, expanding IRS enforcement, and closing a loophole used to lower tax rates on investment income. With Republicans unanimously opposed, all eyes were on Senator Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrat from Arizona, a centrist who has previously opposed closing that loophole. Her aide said she was reviewing the legislation with Manchin. "She'll make a good decision based on facts, and I'm relying on that," said Manchin. What the editorial said. "Surprise," said the Los Angeles Times. "After years of dangerous inaction on climate, the bill's resurrection offers a ray of hope. It's not perfect. At Manchin's insistence, it includes wrong-headed concessions to polluting industries, such as requirements for new oil and gas leases on public lands. But its clean energy subsidies and methane reduction measures would cut greenhouse gas emissions by an estimated 40% by 2030. It's a transformational achievement at a moment when the cost of a warming planet become more apparent every day." This cynically named bill will do nothing to address inflation, which is voters' biggest concern, said National Review. "Instead, it will unleash new spending on government boondoggles while funneling taxpayer money to Democratic special interests. The corporate tax hikes will stifle growth at a time when the economy is already contracting, while expanded tax enforcement means more middle-class taxpayers will be squeezed by the IRS. Hooray." What the columnist said. ignore the Republican false scaremongering that the bill will raise taxes on average Americans, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. In reality, the tax side changes are so narrow that relatively few people should even notice. The minimum corporate tax targets mega companies that pay zero in corporate income taxes, even as they report giant earnings to shareholders, while the closure of the carried interest loophole ends a dodge that allows wealthy investment managers to pay lower tax rates than their receptionists. And added IRS funding should only worry tax cheats. The much maligned Manchin has been right about everything, said Tim Miller in The Bulwark. He sounded the alarm on inflation when leading Democrats dismissed the issue, and now he's delivered a package that includes serious climate investment for the base, a tax hike on bankers for the populist, and deficit reduction for right-leaning independents. Without Manchin's strategic centrism giving Democrats a Senate seat in a deep red state, his party would not have put Ketanji Brown Jackson on the Supreme Court, or passed the child tax credit, or gotten anything done in the Biden presidency. Put some respect on the man's name. This is a big shot in the arm for Biden, said John Harris in Politico. He looks to be pulling a significant victory out of the hat 3 months before the midterms, a plot twist that invites a reappraisal of his presidency. The old-school dealmaker recalibrated when his maximalist goals proved unreachable, giving Manchin and Schumer cover to achieve incremental ones and to emerge with a historic package that will have real impact. Biden's presidency is still defined by his limits, but it has more life and more possibility than seemed possible a week ago. And we'll read a second main story. U.S. strike kills al-Qaeda's top leader. What happened? After years of searching, the U.S. killed al-Qaeda's leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, this week in a Kabul drone strike. Considered more responsible for 9/11 than anyone besides Osama bin Laden, Zawahiri was on the balcony of a safe house in downtown Kabul when he was reportedly hit by two Hellfire R-9X missiles, weapons designed to limit collateral damage by deploying six blades just before impact, rather than causing an explosion. Less than a year after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the strike gives a boost to President Biden, who views it as a success for his over-the-horizon strategy of protecting American interest without an on-the-ground military presence. Zawahiri's successor may be his lieutenant, jihadist Saif al-Adel, a survivor of al-Qaeda's founding generation, who is believed to be in Iran. Zawahiri's presence in the Afghan capital undercut Taliban assurances that Afghanistan would not become a refuge for terrorists. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it grossly violated the Doha Agreement for the American withdrawal. Members of the Taliban-affiliated Haqqani terrorist network raced to the safe house, located next door to the Taliban's interior ministry, after the strike, alongside Taliban intelligence officials. The Taliban's bond with al-Qaeda was cemented when the then Taliban chief, Mullah Omar, refused to hand over bin Laden to the U.S. after 9/11. While less visible to Americans than its 2001 iteration, al-Qaeda now serves as an inspiration for a disparate Islamist movement and claims more total fighters across more countries, particularly in Africa, than it did 21 years ago. What the columnist said. Biden deserves credit for the strike, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post, but he also deserves blame for creating the conditions that allowed Zawahiri to set up operations in a city that had been liberated from al-Qaeda with American blood. When the U.S. killed bin Laden in 2011, the raid led to a wealth of intelligence. Thanks to Biden, the U.S. no longer has boots on the ground, and the drone strike destroyed all the actionable intelligence Zawahiri possessed. Actually, this success seems to vindicate the president's belief in America's over-the-horizon counterterrorism capabilities, said Brian Glenn Williams in The Hill. I was skeptical when the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan last year, but the CIA's ability to track down and kill the most wanted man in the world testifies to the viability of the strategy. When we combine strong intelligence gathering, state-of-the-art weapons, and special forces skill, America no longer needs to occupy foreign lands to take out terrorists who operate in them. The U.S. made some disastrous mistakes in the counterterrorism crusade it launched after 9/11, but it remained focused on seeking justice for more than two decades, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. Zawahiri became a daily obsession for American counterterrorism specialists. That's a warning for the Russians, Chinese, or anyone else who doubts U.S. staying power. Americans might look impatient and undependable, but they have long memories. Our controversy of the week is Trump. Is there strong evidence he committed crimes? The January 6th committee has done its job, said Noah Bookbinder in Salon, and now it's time for Attorney General Merrick Garland to do his. Through videos, text, and witness testimony from inside Trump's White House, the committee laid out an overwhelming case for multiple criminal charges against Donald Trump. We now know for certain that Trump was repeatedly told by advisors, including then Attorney General Bill Barr, that there was no election fraud and that advisors who concocted a phony elector scheme knew it was illegal and sought a pardon. We know that Trump knew the rioters were armed and further incited the mob even when Vice President Mike Pence's life was in real danger. Now there are reports that the famously cautious Garland and his federal prosecutors are asking Trump's inner circle about his actions before, during, and after January 6th, and issuing subpoenas for testimony and records. Trump's legal team is worried and is already preparing possible defenses, said Aswin Subasing and Adam Ronsley in Rolling Stone. A central strategy will be blaming Fall Guys. That is, shifting blame from Trump to his advisors for the efforts to overturn the election. That would actually be a strong defense, said Jonathan Turley in The Hill. The January 6th hearings have conclusively shown that while some advisors told Trump he'd lost the election and should concede, he was hearing the opposite from lawyers Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Sidney Powell, and the rest of what more sober-minded staffers dubbed Team Crazy. Trump's reliance on Team Crazy's advice could persuade a jury that he truly believed the election had been stolen and that his subsequent actions and statements were therefore legal, if delusional. Unlike the January 6th committee, said Edward Luce in the Financial Times, the DOJ will need to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. Jurors will know the defendant retains the devotion of millions of Americans, many of them armed. Garland can take pressure off the jury, said Rebecca Beitsch and Harper Neidig in The Hill, by focusing on specific, concrete crimes where Trump's guilt will be easy to prove. But even if Trump honestly thought the election was stolen, for example, that wouldn't change the fact that he tried to obstruct an official proceeding, Congress certification of the vote, a crime for which hundreds of Capitol rioters have already been convicted. The easiest path to a conviction, said Chris Strom in Bloomberg.com, may be to charge Trump for his role in submitting lists of fake electors from seven swing states. Forgery and document fraud are everyday crimes and the public understands, and for which people are imprisoned on a daily basis. No, said Charles Sykes in the Bulwark. Garland should go as big as possible. The MAGA faithful are going to react with total fury to any prosecution of their orange god king. So Garland may as well bring charges that reflect the gravity of his attempted coup, seditious conspiracy, fraud, obstruction, and incitement. Failing to charge Trump with crimes would prove presidents are above the law, said Kimberly Atkins Store in the Boston Globe. That precedent has already been set by the absence of legal consequences for previous presidents who committed apparent crimes, including Warren Harding, Richard Nixon, and Bill Clinton. It falls to the mild-mannered Garland to now end that toxic tradition. Our future as a nation depends on it. And it was a good week for birds, mice, and dogs after the Polish Academy of Sciences officially classified cats as an invasive alien species because they kill billions of birds and small mammals a year and have a negative influence on native biodiversity. It was a good week for Mick Jagger, who celebrated his 79th birthday on a European tour with the Rolling Stones that marks their 60th anniversary as a band. The great-grandfather of three partied with his ballerina girlfriend, Melanie Hamrick, 35, who is the mother of their five-year-old son. And it was a good week for George Jetson, the hapless future-dwelling patriarch of the popular 1960s cartoon series, which indicated he was born on July 31st, in the impossibly far-off year of 2022. But it was a bad week for sequels. After President Biden's physician said he is suffering a COVID rebound after taking the antiviral Paxlovid. While Biden continues to feel well, the doctor said, he is once again testing positive and experiencing a bit of return of a loose cough. It was a bad week for economic indicators after a Duane Reade store in New York City decided to encase its $3.99 cans of Spam processed meat in plastic anti-theft containers. And finally, it was a bad week for grammar after Laverne Spicer, a Republican congressional candidate from Florida, claimed that there are no pronouns in the Constitution. Critics pointed that there are dozens of pronouns in the Constitution, including the first word, we. The title of the briefing this week is Stealing COVID Aid. And it has a photograph of a fancy car which says, the seizure of a Lamborghini bought with federal aid. Billions in pandemic relief dollars were wasted or pocketed by scammers. How did that happen? Was COVID relief successful? In many ways, yes, it helped prevent what most economists agree would have been the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. As the pandemic hit in the spring of 2020 amid a massive wave of hospitalizations and deaths, many businesses shut down or reduced operations, and the U.S. economy lost more than 20 million jobs. Lawmakers scrambled to act, and in late March, President Trump signed the $2 trillion CARES Act, a sprawling package that included direct payments to households, enhanced unemployment insurance, and small business loans. In March 2021, with millions still out of work, President Biden signed a second COVID relief bill, this one for $1.9 trillion. Under the Trump and Biden administrations, the federal government allocated $6 trillion toward pandemic relief. A Moody's Analytics report says these collective efforts saved the country from a major double-dip recession. In the midst of a paralyzing pandemic, 2020 saw the biggest drop in poverty in five decades and no major increase in hunger. Once vaccines arrived, the economy rebounded briskly and unemployment hit record lows. What the money did, said Louise Shiner, an economist with the Brookings Institution, was to basically make sure when we could reopen, people had money to spend, their credit rating wasn't ruined, they weren't evicted, and kids weren't going hungry. Was there a price for that success? Yes, the San Francisco Fed estimates that trillions injected into the economy added as much as 3 percentage points to the inflation rate by late 2021. In addition, an alarming proportion of money was misspent or stolen. Of $873 billion in unemployment insurance distributed, a recent Labor Department report estimates that at least $1 in $6 should not have been paid out, with a significant portion attributable to fraud. Cybersecurity firm Dark Tower discovered that more than 200,000 users of the messaging app Telegram belonged to groups that traded tips on the best states to target for unemployment money. Criminal networks in China, Nigeria, and elsewhere started identity theft rings. Aid targeted to businesses fared little better. A University of Texas analysis of 11.8 million Paycheck Protection Program loans found a 15% fraud rate, potentially costing taxpayers more than $117 billion. About $3.9 billion in Small Business Administration loans went to 57,000 entities on the Treasury Department's Do Not Pay list. How did that happen? Scammers invented or misrepresented businesses to get loans. One 55-year-old Texan was later convicted of netting $24 million through 15 fraudulent loan applications. He spent some of the money on a Bentley convertible and a Corvette Stingray. A California businessman was charged with using $5 million in aid to buy a Lamborghini and a Ferrari. A family of Christian missionaries received $8.4 million from the SBA by falsely claiming to run a ministry with 486 employees and a $2.7 million monthly payroll. Why the lack of oversight? The government hadn't distributed aid on this massive scale before, and with millions of people and businesses hurting, it chose speed over precision. Many state unemployment agencies, hobbled by archaic, decades-old computer systems and understaffing from years of budget cuts, were quickly overwhelmed. 20 states did not perform all the required background checks on applicants. The SBA, a congressional subcommittee found, may have approved 1.6 million loans without evaluating the applications. With loans rubber-stamped 500 at a time, even obvious red flags, such as overseas client locations, sometimes didn't prevent approval. Can the money be recovered? Only a small fraction of it. Federal authorities have so far recaptured $4 billion, less than 3% of wrongful payments of unemployment money, and they have opened more than 1,150 investigations of potential misuse of various relief funds. Government and bank investigators have returned $10 billion in misallocated business relief to government coffers. But the vast majority of the fraud remains unpunished. The Justice Department lacks the resources to investigate and prosecute tens of thousands of perpetrators. Was there a better way? Governments around the world have spent more than $15 trillion on pandemic relief, but most countries did not offer direct cash to citizens, regardless of need, as the U.S. did. Instead, they funneled the money to laid-off workers through their employers and existing welfare organizations. Some level of fraud was inevitable, but even compared with a previous stimulus, COVID spending was wildly inefficient. Only 0.6% of the $831 billion American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, for example, went to fraudsters. Strengthening, modernizing, and expanding government social safety net systems could make large-scale waste less likely in the next emergency. But George Washington University economics professor Tara Sinclair points out there isn't much appetite for spending billions now to prevent future fraud. It's hard to convince taxpayers, she said, that if we do this, it'll look like a lot of money now, but the next time there's a crisis, we won't end up just spending a trillion or two willy-nilly. And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Alito's Religious Crusade. Justice Samuel Alito has made it clear that he views an increasingly secular society as a threat to the Supreme Court, as a threat the Supreme Court must fight, said Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern. In a recent speech on religious freedom at an event sponsored by the Notre Dame Law School's Religious Liberty Initiative, which filed briefs arguing for overturning Roe, Alito quoted the Gospels while emphasizing the central role of religion in democratic governance. With characteristic sarcasm, he welcomed the disapproval of foreign critics of his abortion ruling, including Prince Harry, Boris Johnson, and the leaders of France and Canada, as proof his opinion was correct. In economically advanced countries, Alito warned, religious liberty is under threat from an increasingly secular society and its new moral code. That code includes women's equality and reproductive rights, LGBTQ rights, and secular public education, everything Alito despises. Many Americans, he complained, think religion is just not all that important or worthy of special protection. But Alito and the Christian conservatives who now control the court, he indicated, will not put up with a separation of church and state. Their mission, to empower fellow believers to govern the godless. Preventing another coup attempt. What if Mike Pence had said yes, asked David French. What if he'd caved in to ex-President Trump's pressure and declared him the winner of the 2020 election? America probably would have survived that moment, but the key word there is probably. Now we have proposed legislation that would address the key reason that Trump and his corrupt cadre of loyalists were able to put Pence in that position. The Electoral Count Act of 1887. The convoluted wording of the act is worse than a mess. It gives Congress the right to object to electoral votes on flimsy or non-existent pretext and overturn a presidential election upon a simple majority vote. It also vaguely defines the vice president's role in counting the votes. To rectify these dangerous flaws, a bipartisan coalition of senators has drafted the Electoral Count Reform Act. It's a monumental improvement that fixes the ECA's biggest problems and specifies that the vice president cannot reject a single Electoral College vote. House Democrats are demanding even broader electoral reforms, but they risk creating a bill that will fail to pass the Senate, leaving the ECA intact for the 2024 election. And as 2020 demonstrated, failure could be catastrophic. This comes from Europe. Why we must welcome the Russians. Since Finland lifted COVID travel restrictions last month, our country has been awash in Russian terrorists, said Issa Makinen. And many Finns don't want them here. Finland is the most convenient gateway to Europe for Russians because it's easy to get a Schengen visa there that allows them to go on a nearly any EU country. But it feels wrong to look up from a paper in which we read about dead Ukrainian children and see a happy group of vacationing Russians at the next cafe table. The contrast between the sunny tourist circuit and the darkness of Ukraine is too much to bear. Finland's four largest parliamentary groups now say they support keeping Russian tourists out entirely to punish Russia for its invasion. But that would be both impractical and unfair. There are 90,000 native Russian speakers living in Finland, many of whom have relatives in Russia. Will we keep out grandma? And what about the many Russians who oppose the war and want to come to the West to meet like-minded people? This is Vladimir Putin's war, and just as EU sanctions target only the oligarchs and the politicians who support him, so should a Finnish ban. We should deny visas to those Russians who are responsible for the war, not the vacationers and babushkas. Time for the last word, our in-depth article. The writer who walked away. Gary Smith was the greatest sports writer of his generation, said Joseph Ben Kahn in Victory Journal. Then, at the height of his powers, he decided he'd had enough. Gary Smith boarded the first train out of Rome and took it to the end of the line. He crossed the street right as the bus pulled up and rode it to the end of the line, too. Now a little red car slid to a stop beside his outstretched thumb, and a man with wild black hair and wild black eyes beckoned him to get in. It was a linguistic scramble as the man attempted to engage Smith. Italian, then English, and finally a slapdash mess of Spanish and French to get to the most pressing matter. Where to? Wherever you're going, Smith responded. And so the man turned the key and they set off, the Talking Heads' Psycho Killer playing on repeat. Eventually they pulled into a tiny village, Castel Viscardo, on the calf of Italy's boot, 4,200 miles and a universe from the Manhattan Sports Illustrated office. It was late summer, 1983. Gary Smith stayed in town that night, and then for months thereafter, working at the brickyard and picking the region's famous grapes. He'd be back again with his wife, and then three more times with children in tow. The magazine had paid his way across the Atlantic, but the train ride and the bus ride and the months abroad had been for only him. None of it made the story. It was never meant to. 2 years ago, a friend from Charleston mentioned a coworker who taught mindfulness to elementary school students. A few years in, someone finally asked that friend, "You know who that is, right?" It was the sports writer, Gary Smith. The image of Smith, winner of a record 4 national magazine awards, living anonymously, was perfectly antithetical to that of a grizzled sports writer telling war stories from a bar stool. The unassuming legend with an unobtrusive name had seemingly disappeared into an afterlife on the Carolina coast. Ben Yagoda once wrote on Slate, "Gary Smith is not only the best sports writer in America, he's the best magazine writer in America. The only injustice is that outside the small world of editors who vote for the National Magazine Awards and the even smaller subset of Sports Illustrated readers who pay attention to bylines, he is a nobody. Smith existed apart from Sports Illustrated, even when his writing was definitional for the magazine. He looked like a member of John Denver's backup band, to use SI writer Steve Rushen's framing, and always lived far from New York City, in Charleston for decades, with time in Bolivia, Australia, and Spain peppered in between. He wrote just 4 stories a year for 3 decades, each a sprawling excavation of a sports figure's soul. Even then, during the magazine's flush times, he was an anomaly. Last spring, I stood in front of a packed cafe in Charleston's French Quarter. Smith, a lithe 68-year-old, rode up a few minutes late, waving and apologizing from the seat of a black beach cruiser. He wore a cerulean t-shirt, jeans, and sneakers. His smile cast lines around his bright blue eyes, and his thin beard was white, but he looked boyish. It took a moment to find a lunch option for Smith, who struggles with spicy foods and is vegetarian. As we ate, our conversation bounced from his first newspaper job to Al Davis' coaching career to Smith's rock band, Post-Life Crisis. When it jumped to the precarious state of sports journalism, Smith leaned back in his chair. "This sounds like it's going to be a mournful story," he says, grinning. "The asteroid came and there's one dinosaur left, and he's out in Charleston." As Smith and I spoke again and again this spring, the conversation would inevitably return to why retire. But to try to place Smith in the world of anxiety and striving of the modern journalist is a folly. In David Halberstam's book on the Vietnam War, The Best and the Brightest, he wrote of his apprehension in taking on the years-long book project. "A journalist always wonders, if my byline disappears, have I disappeared as well?" Smith smiled and closed his eyes as he listened to the quote. "You pour yourself into the writing, but it is not yourself," he says after a pause. "If you let it get that sticky, you're stuck." Gary Smith started his career in journalism while he was still in high school. His older sister, Sue — Gary is the 4th of 9 Smith kids — had won the Delaware Junior Miss Pageant and sat on the judging panel the next year alongside the sports editor at the Wilmington News Journal. While there, Smith's mother asked for advice for her sports-obsessed 16-year-old son, and the editor said he should come by the paper the next day. Smith got a job taking on tasks like tracking down high school scores and typesetting horse race results. He went on to the Philadelphia Daily News and then to Inside Sports, Newsweek's experiment in literary sports journalism, where he was hired as the only staff writer. The magazine folded after 3 years, and it was then, in 1982, that Sports Illustrated reached out, offering a coveted staff writing position. Smith, just 28 years old, responded with a counteroffer. He would take half the money to be on contract to write 4 feature stories per year. "I was just feeling like a student of life at that point. There's so much I want to see and learn that if I'm on the wheel with deadlines, I just won't be able to experience," he says. Smith wrote under contract for 8 years until the realities of adulthood, a wife and kids and a mortgage, made health care and benefits a necessity. By that point, he'd built up enough capital, penning seminal profiles of Mike Tyson and Muhammad Ali, as well as portraits of Soviet pole vaulters and eccentric aces, to come on staff at the higher rate while continuing the 4 stories per year structure. It was 1990. Gary Smith had the best job in sports journalism. The SI newsroom at 1271 Avenue of the Americas was the big leagues of sports media. Every week, journalists and photographers would file from every corner of the sports world, and more than 3,120,000-page glossy behemoths would land at newsstands and front doors. At the time, Rick Riley was the more boisterous star of the magazine, the grenade lobbing writer USA Today called the closest thing sports writing ever had to a rock star, once appeared in a Miller Lite ad alongside Rebecca Rumminge. Smith was more like sports writing Towns Van Zandt. SI contemporaries dubbed the soft-spoken Smith the demon beat writer for his uncanny ability to uncover each subject's hidden demons. His Tyson profile charted the path from a traumatic childhood to the heavyweight belt. His Andre Agassi story traced the tennis player's obsessive rebellion back to an overbearing father. Riley and Smith had an unlikely friendship, sort of a mismatch socks, as Russian put it, and were inseparable while covering the Olympics or on the SI retreats, dancing, drinking, and singing karaoke. To Riley, who eventually took a lucrative deal to move to ESPN in 2008, it was fascinating to see how Smith leveraged his industry capital into more freedom rather than more money. A lot of people would probably have been like, screw that. You guys love me, you need me, I'll write more, but you've got to triple my salary, Riley says. But no, he wants less work. You know, I'll do the same salary, but a lot less work, so that I can pour myself even deeper into these people. The athletes agreed to let that light be shined on their darkest parts because the illumination itself held value. The trade was, you'll explore some of my shadows in this piece, but out of it, I'll get this coverage in a national forum that can be beneficial for my career or what I want to offer, Smith says. As the magazine industry shrank and the athlete's pulpit grew, the calculus inverted. The magazine needs the athlete now, not the other way around. So the shadows get shut down and the person controls the whole thing. It's a step of trust no longer necessary for celebrities to take. So why take it? That now legendary Tyson profile contains a revelatory scene. At one point, the heavyweight champ longingly reminisces about robbing strangers to the actress Robin Givens as they ride through Brownsville, Brooklyn, in a silver Lincoln stretch limousine. Being profiled by Gary Smith would be like being paraded down Main Street naked in a cage. Everyone sees everything you are, warts and beauty, Riley says, and you couldn't really complain about it because he usually got you so right. But Riley's framing distorts Smith's actual approach. The profiles are less parade than portraiture. As his SI colleague S.L. Price wrote when Smith retired in 2014, Smith had little interest in painting Mike Tyson or Allen Iverson as pure villains or Dean Smith as pure hero. He knew better. His great achievement was an inversion of sport's central allure, the way it reduces messy existence to clear winners and losers, good guys and bad guys. For Smith, there was never pressure to chase clicks or move the salacious stuff to the lead. There were ESPN offers, sure, but he valued the space and time afforded by his SI gig. There were many inquiries about book deals, but he'd already spent months pulling back the layers of his subject. So eventually, for Smith, the calculus changed. To find stories where I felt like I could learn something and wouldn't be repeating on a subject. That grew more challenging in the later years, he said. There was a bit of a sense of not having as much desire to go and fill all those notebooks. It wasn't as fervent a desire as the one that had been compelling me all the way up until that moment. It was time to walk away. Smith tells me he's writing a novel, a heavily researched, imagined history of Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson. It's been 7 years, and he's still not certain when it'll be done. But he's sure it won't be long now. For decades, he'd had 3 months per story. Now he spends 4 hours every day basking in the novel's world. I don't feel any need of a deadline to get me to produce something. I'd rather just work until it gets better, he says. The process is really what I love. The doing of it, not having it done. So perhaps that was the secret all along. It's what let him live for months in Italy, a year into the SI gig others would die for. It's what let him stay put for three decades instead of chasing greener grass. It's also what let him walk away. Today, the most decorated sports writer of his generation spends time teaching students at Title I schools mindfulness as a tool to be attentive and calm their nerves. He rarely shares a Tyson or Tiger Woods anecdote. It's an incredibly complicated thing that we're thrust into as human beings. You can either take it at face value and just scramble or survive, or you can try to understand as best you can what's really happening here, inside of us, around us, Smith says. His years of reading, writing, and exploring were in the service of a goal: to learn how to play this game most wisely, with the least amount of suffering and the most amount of enjoyment. It wasn't Smith who first shared the Castelvescardo story. It was Riley. He brought it up, still a bit awestruck by his friend after all these years. He just wants to explore the world until there's no inch left, he says. When he explores it all, he says, "Wait a minute, there's about 8 inches between my ears. Let's see what that's like." Now he explores that too. When I ask Smith about the trip, he corrects an error in Riley's retelling. He'd been in Rome, not Madrid. Then he's off, telling me about the hand gestures at the crowded bar and how they baked bricks in the old-fashioned way in the afternoon sun. He'd been in Europe on assignment, profiling an Italian long-distance swimmer ahead of the 1984 Olympic Games. The interviews were done, so he headed to the station to ride the first train and then the first bus to the end of the line. "When I got to the end of the line, I got off and put my thumb out," he says. "Whoever picked me up, wherever they're going, that was where I'm going to land. And you know, just see what happened." This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in Victory Journal. I'm going to read two obituaries for you today, starting with the Star Trek actress who shattered stereotypes, Nichelle Nichols, 1932 to 2022. Just a year after taking the role of Lieutenant Uhura, Nichelle Nichols decided she'd had enough of Star Trek. While she liked playing the Enterprise communications officer, one of the first black female television characters in a leading role, she had viewed the part as a stepping stone to other work, preferably on Broadway. And star William Shatner's ego was already grating on her. But at an NAACP fundraiser, the organizer introduced her to someone he called your biggest fan. A smiling Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of how much he and his family admired her work on the show. When she said she was leaving the cast, his face fell. "You can't do that," she recalled him saying. "Don't you understand? For the first time, we're seen as we should be seen." That conversation, she later said, convinced her that playing Lieutenant Uhura was something more than just a job. She stayed with the series until its end in 1969. The daughter of a chemist in suburban Robin, Illinois, Nichols first worked professionally as a singer and dancer in Chicago, said the Associated Press, starting at 14 and touring with Duke Ellington a few years later. Her big screen debut in 1959's Carmen Jones was followed by several small film and TV roles. A guest spot on the 1963 drama The Lieutenant introduced her to Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry, and the two had a brief romantic relationship. Nichols' red mini-dress uniform in Star Trek permitted her to flaunt her dancer's legs, said the Washington Post, but the Enterprise sole female officer was usually crisp and businesslike. One exception was a 1968 episode in which she and Shatner's Captain Kirk are forced by hostile telekinetic aliens to embrace in one of the first interracial kisses on American primetime television. Nichols went on to release three albums, but Lieutenant Uhura defined her career, said People. She appeared in the first six Star Trek movies and became a key outreach ambassador for NASA, recruiting women and people of color as astronauts. Even after her 2018 diagnosis with dementia, Nichols frequently attended fan conventions. Last December, she was seen waving, blowing kisses, and flashing Star Trek's famous Vulcan salute at L.A. Comic Con. "I am still very proud of Uhura," she wrote in her 1994 memoir, "and what she represented, not only in her time, but in ours." The defensive genius who transformed basketball. Bill Russell, 1934 to 2022. Bill Russell was basketball's first black superstar and the most prolific winner in the game's history. Over a 15-year period beginning in 1955, the goateed 6'9" center, who won two NCAA championships and an Olympic gold medal, then led the Boston Celtics to an astounding 11 NBA championships in 13 years, the last two while serving as both a player and the league's first black coach. In the process, the five-time MVP transformed the game, leveraging his preternatural shot blocking and rebounding ability to control a game defensively in a manner until then completely foreign to the NBA, said former Celtics teammate Tommy Heinsohn. A target of virulent racism in Boston, Russell distinguished himself off the court with his outspoken support for civil rights. In the late 1950s, he accused the NBA of keeping black players down with a tacit quota system. In 1963, he joined the March on Washington, and after civil rights leader Medgar Evers was killed, he opened an integrated basketball camp in Mississippi. "I don't work for acceptance. I am what I am," he said. "If you like it, that's nice. If not, I couldn't care less." Russell was born in Monroe, Louisiana, where his father worked in a paper bag factory, said the New York Times. Despite a warm home life, his childhood was seared by racism, and when he was nine, the family left the South for public housing in Oakland. He didn't start on his high school basketball team until he was a senior, but a scout saw his potential, and he won a scholarship to the University of San Francisco. "There he became a phenom," said Deadspin, "using his size, lengthy wingspan, shot-blocking prowess, and advanced instincts to lead the team to consecutive national championships. After winning Olympic gold in 1956, he was drafted by the Celtics, becoming the team's only black player. In his debut season, Russell helped the team to its first NBA championship, beginning a winning streak that brought the Celtics eight consecutive titles, said the Washington Post. That record has never been matched. An intense competitor, Russell would throw up in the locker room before games, then go out and stun crowds by shutting down opposing teams' offenses almost single-handedly. When Wilt Chamberlain entered the NBA in 1959, their electrifying rivalry became a highlight of the league, with Chamberlain posting better personal stats, but Russell claiming most of the victories. Russell's relationship with Boston was fractious, said the Boston Globe. His court dominance made him both an icon and an irritant in a city unaccustomed to a visible and vocal black man. His suburban home was once vandalized by intruders who smashed up his trophies, scrawled racial slurs on the wall, and defecated in the beds. In his memoir, Russell called the city a flea market of racism, and his refusal to sign autographs in a manner perceived as aloof made for a remote relationship with Boston's predominantly white fans. When the Celtics retired his number 6 jersey in 1972, he insisted on a private ceremony. In 1975, he declined to attend his own induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame in nearby Springfield, Massachusetts. After retiring from the Celtics in 1969 and moving to an island near Seattle, Russell had an eclectic career, said the Los Angeles Times. He appeared in movies and commercials, worked as an NBA color commentator, golfed, and had two more coaching stints with the Seattle Supersonics in the 70s and the Sacramento Kings in the 80s. In later years, he was showered with honors, including an honorary Harvard doctorate, a Presidential Medal of Freedom bestowed by President Obama, and a statue unveiled in Boston's City Hall Plaza in 2013. He remained wary of public adoration, but acknowledged fierce pride in his court achievements. If you can take something to levels that very few other people can reach, he said in 1999, then what you're doing becomes art. And we have run a little deep in the hour, so we'll wrap up with a couple of quotes. The first, from Ronald Reagan, quoted in the Eagle Times, is, "Freedom is a fragile thing, and it's never more than one generation away from extinction." And Pete Townsend, quoted in Far Out, says, "Rock and roll might not solve your problems, but it does let you dance all over them." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.